Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is May 11th, and I'm going to take some questions in just a second, but I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. So we have a lecture today, we have a lecture on Thursday, and we have a lecture 1 week from today, which is May 18th. All right, then on May 20th, which is a week from this Thursday, there is no class because that's finals week. All right, and I can't give lecture, well, it's unclear whether I could give a lecture during finals week or not, but typically that's problematic because you might have a final scheduled at that time. So anyway, on the 20th of May, on Thursday, there's no class, which means then that your final exam is Tuesday, May 25th in this room at 10:30 a.m. That's strange. So it's an hour earlier, 10:30 until 12:30. And the chapters will be 14, 16, and 17 on May 25th. All right, any questions on that? So I think we're good for that. Okay, question? No. All right. So we were still talking about respiratory system last time. There's just a couple things that we need to look over once again. Here's a sign-in sheet. Just hold on to that for just a little bit. We need to look at transport of some compounds in the blood. So I asked you before lecture to look at these two series of numbers right here. It's a table, 16.7, and you see that the first number represents basically the concentration of oxygen in a mixture of gas, and that's what the partial pressure. And then the next line is the percent oxyhemoglobin. All right, so here we have on the board, a hemoglobin molecule. How is most of the oxygen transported in your blood? It's going to be bound to hemoglobin. So very little actually can dissolve in plasma, just a few percent, but most of the oxygen has to bind to hemoglobin. So we're going to write a chemical equation on the board. We got hemoglobin, and what can bind to hemoglobin? Oxygen. All right, we looked also last time that carbon monoxide can, and it has a much higher affinity, and that can poison the hemoglobin, so you can't transport oxygen in your body. That's like being strangled if you're breathing carbon monoxide. All right, so if we have hemoglobin and oxygen, what does that produce? Yeah, you see it on the slide up there, oxyhemoglobin. All right, and should this be a reversible or an irreversible process? Reversible. Well, why do you say reversible? Yeah, because hemoglobin is just a transporter. You do not want hemoglobin binding oxygen and not giving it up to tissues, because then your tissues would starve to death of lack of oxygen, right? So this arrow right here, how should we really draw that arrow? Yeah, okay, really good. So that's a nice equilibrium reaction right there. So what happens if we were going to reduce oxygen concentration, or reduce the partial pressure of oxygen, which way would this equation readjust itself? To the right or to the left? It would go to the left, right? So oxyhemoglobin would be converted to hemoglobin, and that would help buffer the concentration or the partial pressure of oxygen. Right? Or in the other circumstance, if oxygen concentration increases, which way is this reaction going to go? It's going to be forced to the right, and you should know two ways of describing why that reaction moves like that. What would you use? How would you explain that? Two principles. Actually, it's one principle with two different names. Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. Right, because that's a completely reversible reaction. Okay, so looking at these numbers up on table 16.7, I said, tell me what's the relationship between partial pressure of oxygen and percent oxyhemoglobin. If one goes up, what happens to the other? Yeah, do you see that? You have to look from right to left. As the percent oxygen increases, what happens to percent oxyhemoglobin formation? It increases as well. So what do we call that kind of relationship? It's directly related to each other, right? So partial pressure of oxygen, or the concentration of oxygen, is directly related to the percent oxyhemoglobin formation. Okay, so if we plot these numbers out on a curve, which is our next graph right here, so here we have percent oxyhemoglobin saturation as a percent versus the partial pressure of oxygen, we get a curve that looks like this. All right, and so it's a nice sigmoidal type curve, and as the partial pressure of oxygen gets over 100 millimeters of mercury, notice that the hemoglobin is completely saturated with oxygen and it can't bind anymore. But as we reduce the partial pressure of oxygen, look what happens to the percent saturation of oxyhemoglobin. It starts to, of course, decrease because it's directly related. Okay? So what two circumstances that we're really interested in is the partial pressure of oxygen in veins at rest, which is about 40 millimeters of mercury, and the partial pressure of oxygen in arteries. And we're talking the systemic circulation, not the pulmonary circulation. All right, so in around the lungs, notice that hemoglobin is almost 100% saturated with oxygen, right, because they have the partial pressure of 100 millimeters of mercury. All right, and as that blood travels to capillaries, then, right, at capillaries, they absorb oxygen. All right, so if they're taking oxygen out of this equation right here, what's going to happen to oxyhemoglobin? It's going to dissociate to produce hemoglobin and oxygen, and that oxygen is further going to be used by the tissues. So by the time blood passes through the capillaries, the PO2 is 40 millimeters of mercury. All right, so here we see, that the delivery of oxygen to the tissues because of the law of mass action, okay, is what, almost 15% saturation of that hemoglobin. All right, so this is a nice special delivery system for oxygen for tissues because there's a much less pressure, partial pressure of oxygen in veins or these capillaries compared to arteries. All right, so that describes the delivery of oxygen. Okay, another question that I had for you was, capillaries are right in between arteries and veins in here. So you might say here's a proximal capillary, then here's the distal capillary right over here. So there's going to be a change in oxygen concentration as blood flows through capillaries, because those tissues are going to be using up oxygen. They're going to be pulling oxygen out of the blood off of oxyhemoglobin when it's being utilized by what organelle utilizes oxygen? Yeah, mitochondria, right, for making ATP. Okay. All right, now, does this make sense? Should the partial pressure of oxygen be low in these veins, right, compared to the air? Because which way will oxygen diffuse? Only from high partial pressures to low partial pressures, right? And as the partial pressure decreases, then hemoglobin actually releases more and more oxygen to the tissues when that happens. All right, so this is a nice dissociation curve for hemoglobin. And before I go to the next slide, I just want to review one last thing over here. And this is hemoglobin. How does hemoglobin get broken down? What are the building blocks for hemoglobin? You got heme, which is a big organic compound, kind of a special compound. It's neither a protein or carbohydrate or lipid or nucleic acid. It's kind of a special organic compound all by itself. Okay. You got heme, and then what else is produced? Yeah, globins, all right? And a globin is what kind of those four basic kinds of molecules? Is it protein, carbohydrate, lipid, or nucleic acid? It's a protein, all right? It's just a protein. And what's the building block of a protein? Amino acids. So globin can then be broken down into amino acids. And then what can your body do with those amino acids? Make more globins or any other kind of protein that your body needs, because that's just the building block for protein synthesis, right? So the globin is recycled into other kinds of proteins or even maintained as globin. Heme, on the other hand, is broken down into iron, and also eventually Billy Rubin. And remember, bilirubin is a pigment. It's a yellow compound, and it's kind of dangerous because in a developing person, it's a neurotoxin, but it can also plug up kidneys, which we're going to get to in the next chapter. All right, so no, and then bilirubin is excreted from your body. Okay, so that's what I want you to know about bilirubin. Okay, let's go to the next slide. All right, so here, table 16.8, we see that this binding curve changes depending on the pH of the tissue. Now, be a little careful on this table because we have pH 7.4, then 7.6, and then 7.2. I don't know why they didn't put it all in a row the way it should be, right? I would say maybe 7.6, 7.4, 7.2. Okay, so we're going to have to skip around a little bit. At 7 point, where's normal pH? Well, it's between 7.2 and 7.4 right here. All right, but let's start at 7.6. The affinity increases, all right, for oxygen. And so we have very little unloading of oxygen in the tissues because this unloading curve changes with pH. It's pH sensitive. And as the pH changes from 7.6 to 7.4, what happens to O2 unloading in tissues? It increases. And let's go to 7.2. Now, which way are we going? 7.6 to 7.4 to 7.2, is that becoming more alkaline or more acidic? More acidic, right? The pH is decreasing. And notice as the pH decreases, what happens to the affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin? It decreases, right? So here we see, as you go from 7.6 to 7.4 to 7.2, you have more oxygen unloading into the tissues. Now, is that beneficial to a particular tissue? And let's think of muscle, all right? And what's happening inside a muscle, or how can you explain that decrease in pH in a muscle under normal physiologic conditions? Maybe lactic acid buildup, right? During what? Exercise. And when a muscle is exercising and becoming more acidic, is there a higher demand for oxygen or a lower demand for oxygen? There's a higher demand for oxygen because the muscle is working, right? But nonetheless, the pH does drop. And what happens to hemoglobin as the pH is dropping when that muscle is exercising? It is actually getting more oxygen because of the binding curve. All right, so that's beneficial. That's a good thing. So here we have that same kind of plot, percent oxyhemoglobin saturation versus the partial pressure of oxygen at three different pHs. And now these dissociation curves, well, they're drawn very nicely, right, from the most alkaline to the normal condition to a little bit acidic condition. So as the tissues become more acidic, which way do these curves move? Do they move to the left or do they move to the right? They move to the right. We call that a right shift. All right, and there's a physiologic concept that I want you to know. When this dissociation curve shifts to the right, what about oxygen delivery to the tissues? Does it increase or decrease as you shift to the right? Okay, so let's take a look. All right, let's just start right here, maybe at 80 millimeters of mercury. Okay, when you're at a very high pH, that's still basically 100% saturated. And when you go down to venous side, let's just say 40 millimeters of mercury, notice that the percent unloading is maybe only about 10%. Right? But at acidic conditions, like 7.2 or more acid conditions compared to normal, all right, from 80 down to 40, look at that. You're almost at, well, you're at 60% saturated, right? So that's almost 40% unloading of oxyhemoglobin in the tissues as they become more acidic, for instance, like during exercise when a muscle is exercising. And what does a muscle need when it's exercising? It needs oxygen to make ATP. You need that ATP for cross-bridge cycling, right? So hemoglobin is very nice in delivering oxygen to tissues when the demands for that oxygen increase because the pH curve, right, or the oxygen saturation curve shifts which way as the tissue becomes more acidic. It shifts to the right. All right, so that's what, if I want you to just memorize one thing, as the oxygen saturation curve moves to the right or shifts to the right, that produces what? More oxygen delivery to the tissues because of that binding constant right there. Okay. Well, there are other things that change when a muscle is exercised. What else changes in a muscle besides pH when it starts to exercise? It's a little warm in here. Okay, that's a clue, yeah. Your body, the temperature of that muscle increases. And guess what happens to the binding curve for oxygen as temperature increases? Oh, I'm going to have to skip this slide. All right, as temperature increases, the affinity decreases. Now, the temperature of the lung still stays pretty much the same, but it's the temperature of the muscle itself. All right, so as the temperature increases, the binding curve shifts to the right. All right, and so what does that mean for oxygen delivery to the tissues? That increases oxygen delivery or increases oxygen unloading during exercise or during if you have a fever. All right, so again, that's very beneficial. As your temperature increases, then hemoglobin delivers more oxygen to the tissues because these curves shift to the right with temperature. All right, one last thing, all right, has to do with the amount of oxygen that's in the air that you're breathing. All right, and as at sea level, that's where we have the highest pressure. A lot of molecules are stacked on top of each other, and as you go up in altitude, the pressure of the air decreases, right? Which means then that the partial pressure of oxygen decreases. And how should you think of the partial pressure of oxygen as? Like the concentration of oxygen in the air around us, right? But it's better to measure it in terms of pressure. So as we go up in the mountains, for instance, the concentration of oxygen decreases. And who can tell me maybe a city that's really high up in the mountains? Like Denver, Colorado, right? That's a mile high, right? So the concentration of oxygen is way reduced. And if you've ever flown into Denver, went skiing or something, you notice for the first couple of days you're really out of breath, right? As a result of that. What are some other cities that are way high up in the mountains? Tahoe, okay, is way up there as well, okay? But Mexico City is very high up in the mountains. Lima, Peru, these are all highly populated areas, right, their capital cities, is way high up in the mountains as well. And there is a compensatory mechanism that happens. All right, when you're at high altitude, there's a low partial pressure, so there's less oxygen in the blood. So here you see a nice red blood cell. And there is a compound called 2,3-diphosphoglycerate, right? And you might kind of recognize that as almost being a intermediate of glycolysis. Right, and it's diphosphoglycerate because at the second and third position here on glycerate, you have a phosphate molecule. Right, so as the partial pressure decreases, you have less inhibition of 2,3-DPG production, which means then that there is an increase in 2,3-DPG. Right, and 2,3-DPG lowers the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen. And when you lower the affinity, which way does that curve shift? It shifts to the right, which means what? Increased oxygen delivery to the tissues, so more oxygen is released from hemoglobin, all right? And that's really a nice thing, right? Because that increased oxygen unloading to tissues does what? Feeds back negatively to the initial stimulus, which was less delivery of oxygen to tissues. So these red blood cells can regulate how much oxygen is delivered to the tissue by regulating the amount of 2,3-DPG that we find in blood. All right, so that shifts to the right as you go up in altitude, and that increases oxygen delivery to tissues. All right, so those are three things that we looked at: decreases in pH, increases in temperature, and increases in 2,3-DPG. All shift the oxygen binding curve to the right, which does what? It increases oxygen delivery to the tissues. Okay, so that's the important thing about that oxygen dissociation curve with hemoglobin. Okay, now this, the effect of pH shifting the curve to the right, we call that the Bohr effect, B-O-H-R. So make sure, that's maybe even a question in your online questions, I'm not sure. Okay, but the, what does the Bohr effect do? What does it explain? Increased oxygen delivery to tissues as pH in the tissues become more acidic. Right, so that's the Bohr effect. Okay. All right, here is a circumstance. On the left, you see some normal red blood cells, which is this biconcave-shaped cell, and it's round and very smooth. Okay, and the slide on the right, you see some red blood cells that have changed their shape. They've turned into like these sickle-shaped cells. All right, so they're no longer round and smooth. They're kind of jagged that have these pointy ends. And the normal red blood cell can flow through very small blood vessels very easily because they can stack up on top of each other. They have nice smooth surfaces, so if they bump into the endothelium of a capillary, they can still flow right through, delivering oxygen to the tissues. Okay. But these cells that are sickle-shaped, right, can't flow through small blood vessels. These ends right here have a tendency to stick to the capillary walls. Right, and of course they might be able to flow through if they're in this longitudinal orientation, but if they're edge on, right, they're going to get stuck in capillaries and occlude a capillary and then prevent blood flow through those capillary beds. These cells are what we call sickled red blood cells. This is typically what happens to somebody that has a mutation in the production of hemoglobin, so that when oxygen concentration decreases in tissues, that causes a conformation of the whole cell, the whole red blood cell. Okay. And we call that sickle cell anemia. These cells will eventually be hemolyzed and destroyed. So somebody with sickle cell disease, not only is there decreased perfusion, okay, you guys, you got to stop talking up there, all right, or go outside in case somebody's listening, all right. Even though I got a microphone on, you still might be distracting to some other people. So these sickle cells plug up very small blood vessels, and if that blood vessel gets plugged up, or these small, it could be a capillary, what happens to the tissue that's being supplied by, oh yeah, it dies, it actually necroses, okay. And you kind of have an experience of what that is like. Have you ever been walking down the sidewalk and then all of a sudden you have a drastic reduction and a curtailment of blood flow to a muscle? What do we call that? Yeah, muscle cramp, right? And the muscle contracts, goes into tetanus, blood can't get to it, all right? And lactic acid is being produced, and fortunately it doesn't last long enough to kill that particular muscle in you, all right? But nonetheless, what are you experiencing? How does that feel? Yeah, it hurts like hell, right? So I just say it hurts like hell. All right, now somebody in sickle cell crisis, because they have some abnormal hemoglobin, being produced because they inherited that condition from their parents, guess how their whole body feels? Yeah, it hurts like hell. It hurts like where you have just a muscle cramp, but that's happening all over their body. All right, so that's a really terrible disease process to have. And when somebody's in intractable pain, what is a very humane thing to do for somebody that's in that kind of pain? Yes, opiates. They have to be treated with opiates. A way to help reduce the sickling of these red blood cells is transfusion and to hydrate them, make sure they're properly hydrated, but of course you have to control their pain. And these cells will sickle anytime these people start to exercise and oxygen concentration starts to decrease in their tissues. All right, so they might be in maybe constant need of opiates as a result. All right, so you just have to be aware that a lot of times if you see patients, right, that are always after opiates, you have to be concerned about them, give them referrals to drug addiction, right, chemical dependence, and you have to be kind of concerned about your own safety because you never really know what a drug seeker is going to do to you in the office if you're not treating them just right. All right, except this class of patients right here with sickle cell anemia, you have to treat them with a lot of compassion because what are they experiencing day in and day out in their life? Yeah, just this searing pain, right? And they're not really the same kind of class of patients as a drug seeker, right? So you have to be very compassionate, make sure they're treated properly. Never withhold pain medication from somebody that needs pain medication because they're experiencing that kind of pain. Okay. All right, so we talked about oxygen delivery. And what's the system that delivers oxygen in your body? It's hemoglobin, okay? All right, but your tissues not only need oxygen, it produces a waste product called carbon dioxide. And so the blood transports carbon dioxide. We saw that for oxygen, it's transported as an oxygen molecule, but CO2 is a totally different kind of compound. Although CO2 can dissolve to a large degree in plasma, we see that CO2, when it's produced by a tissue, when it is metabolizing, 10% can be dissolved in plasma. That's a huge percentage compared to oxygen, but in terms of 100%, that's what? That's a minor fraction of the total CO2 that's produced. Like if I was going to pay you 10% of your salary, cut your salary 90%, what would you say to that? No way, right? So 10% is huge compared to oxygen, but still it's a very small number. So there are other ways that carbon dioxide has to be transported in the blood. Okay. The second way is that carbon dioxide can diffuse through these membranes, and some of it can combine with hemoglobin to make carbaminohemoglobin, right? But that's still an additional 20% only. So that means that leaves 70% has to be transported by some other kind of mechanism. All right. So CO2, all right, still is going to be released from tissues, dissolve in plasma. It can go through the plasma membrane of this red blood cell. And so here we have carbon dioxide and water, all right, combining to form carbonic acid. And there is an enzyme that speeds this reaction up. And that enzyme is, you know, from your last test, carbonic anhydrase, right? And then carbonic acid can dissociate to form hydrogen ions and bicarbonate, all right? And so there's a high level of bicarbonate in the cell, and the bicarbonate can leave the cell. Bicarbonate is just the salt. There's a huge amount of bicarbonate that can dissolve in fluid. It's almost like glucose or salt, right? If you put bicarbonate powder in water, there's a huge amount that can dissolve in that fluid. All right, and since bicarbonate is an anion, when bicarbonate leaves, due to how, why is bicarbonate going to leave the cell? By diffusion, okay, by diffusion, because there's high bicarbonate inside the red blood cell, low in the plasma, so it's just going to move outside the cell, but to maintain the electrical neutrality of the cell, so it doesn't hyperpolarize, a chloride ion has to enter. All right, so we call that a chloride shift, right? And then that's going to neutralize this hydrogen ion that can combine with hemoglobin. All right, so 70% of the carbon dioxide that's produced by metabolism in your cells, right, is carried in the blood as bicarbonate ion. All right, unlike oxygen, how is oxygen carried in the blood? By hemoglobin as an oxygen molecule, but CO2 is carried as a bicarbonate ion, which just dissolves in plasma as a result of the carbonic anhydrase reaction. Okay, so this is in tissues. All right, now which way is CO2 going to want to move? From your tissues into the air or from air into your tissues? And why? Tissues to air because that's the concentration gradient for diffusion, right? So CO2 is just going to move by diffusion, just a nice passive process. All right, so let's look and see what happens now in the lung. So here you have, what is the structure right here? That's the alveolus, right? And the concentration of CO2 in the air is very, very low, right? Not even a percent, 0.003%, very, very low. All right, so carbon dioxide is going to want to move, which from a high concentration dissolved in plasma into the alveolus. Carbon dioxide is going to want to move out of a red blood cell. If there's any bound to hemoglobin, right, like carbaminohemoglobin, then the carbon dioxide is going to dissociate because of Le Chatelier's principle, and then it's going to diffuse into this alveolus because there's a huge concentration gradient. And then the third case over here, bicarbonate in plasma is going to diffuse inside of the red blood cell, and then chloride is going to diffuse out. And if this CO2 is moving from this red blood cell to alveolus, which way is this reaction going to be forced because of Le Chatelier's principle? It's going to be shifted to the right, right? So bicarbonate is going to combine with hydrogen ion to form carbonic acid. And then carbonic acid is going to be broken down into CO2 and oxygen, and then that CO2 is going to dissolve, diffuse into this alveolus right here, which then you will ventilate out of your body. Okay. So this just shows how bicarbonate really transports CO2, the waste product, in your body. Right? And the most important enzyme for that is the carbonic anhydrase enzyme. And this is all just driven by Le Chatelier's principle and diffusion, which is basically the concentration gradient. Okay, so don't forget about this chloride shift. There might be a question in your online questions for that as well. All right, so that's the respiratory system. Okay. Just do it all over again? Okay, you can, because I put it online for you. Yay. Okay. All right, so basically the take-home message, oxygen is transported as the oxygen molecule, but it's bound to hemoglobin. Carbon dioxide is not transported as carbon dioxide, it's transported as bicarbonate ion in the blood. All right, and because of carbonic anhydrase, it just switches forms very easily and moves down, and carbon dioxide can move down its concentration gradient. The other thing that you recognize because of this carbonic anhydrase reaction is what happens, let's go back to this slide. What happens to the pH inside your body when you hypoventilate, when you hold your breath? Now, why would you want to do that? Who knows why? You might want to freak your parents out. But you can do this if you want to, right? What happens to the pH of your body when you hold your breath? What happens? When you hold your breath, what happens to CO2? It's still being produced, right? But the CO2 concentration in the blood increases, right? So here, if we put additional CO2 in this reaction, which way is it going to drive the reaction? To the right, okay? And it's going to produce hydrogen ions. So what happens to the pH of your body when you produce hydrogen ions? Your pH will decrease when you hold your breath. That is very, very true. All right, now let's go the other way. What happens when you hyperventilate? So let's go to the next slide. When you hyperventilate, you're going to drive a lot of CO2 out of your body, and that's going to force this bicarbonate reaction to the left, all right, and it's going to use up hydrogen ions when that happens, and then what happens to the pH inside your body? It goes up. We call that an alkalosis. Right, and so when you hyperventilate, that produces a respiratory alkalosis that changes the pH of your body. So adjusting your ventilatory rate has major implications in adjusting the pH of your body. And maybe over the weekend you can rent Andromeda Strain. It's a science fiction movie, but it's kind of based in some nice physiology. Does anybody see Andromeda Strain? It's a strain of some kind of virus that infects the planet. And the story goes that somebody sent up a satellite and they collected some material from an asteroid or some meteorites or something, and they brought it back to Earth to be analyzed. And there was a virus in that rock that they brought back, and it just started killing people right and left, except for a little baby infant, okay? And the infant's mom was killed. So what happens to an infant when the mom is no longer around? Sounds kind of gruesome, but what happens? No, well, eventually maybe it will die, but it was saved right before it died. The mom died right away, but everybody was shocked that this little baby infant survived long enough to be placed in a nice containment, right? This is science fiction, right? Little incubator, and they fed the infant, of course, and kept it alive. But without the mom, what was it doing? What would you do if your mom was gone? you started to cry, which is what in terms of the respiratory system? Hypoventilation or hyperventilation? Hyperventilation. So what happened to the pH of this infant when it started to cry? It started to go up. That's right, respiratory alkalosis. So the pH increased, and that then changed the environment for this virus. It couldn't reproduce in the infant because the pH was different compared to normal people. So it's kind of an interesting physiologic principle in Andromeda strain, and you can watch it and freak people out that you knew why this infant was going to survive because of that respiratory alkalosis because of the induced crying. Okay. All right, so that's, I just repeated the whole chapter in just a couple minutes. Okay. All right. All right, so that means that we only have, just remember, this the partial pressure of oxygen and percent oxyhemoglobin, right, is nice relationship. They're just directly related to each other, but it changes by what can adjust this relationship. It's still directly related, but it can be adjusted by temperature, by pH, and 2,3-DPG. And all of those things, when they change under conditions of exercise, that shifts the oxygen binding curve to the right, which then enhances unloading of oxygen from oxyhemoglobin. And so those are all very beneficial effects. Okay, so we're going to move on to urinary system. But we're going to start more like at slide number one, I think right here. All right, so we got 2.5 lectures for urinary system. Oh, more than enough time. Maybe we should do some other things, too. We'll see. All right. So you know the components of the urinary system. What are the four growth structures that make up the urinary system? Well, the things, when I say growth, the things that you can see. Okay. Kidney, you can see a kidney. Ureter, you can see. Urinary bladder. And then urethra, and that's how urine is actually produced in that order. Kidney, ureter, into urinary bladder, and then out the urethra. Okay, well, there is a structural and functional unit in the kidney that I want you to know about, and it's the structural and functional unit for urine formation, and that is the nephron, right? So we're gonna pay particular attention to the nephron, and part of the nephron is the glomerulus. That's important for filtration, but the job of the kidney is to regulate salt and water balance in your body, electrolyte balance, maybe acid balance, and blood volume. And if you adjust blood volume, what are you really adjusting in your body? Blood pressure, right? Because of the mechanism through venous return and the Frank-Starling law, right? Through contractility or inotropic properties of the heart, that's going to affect blood pressure. Okay. All right, so kidney is important to regulate plasma and interstitial fluid by the formation of urine. And in the process of urine formation, the kidneys regulate blood volume, right, which then regulates blood pressure. And as a matter of fact, what's the most important long-term mechanism for regulating blood pressure in your body? That's the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, and a part of that mechanism, right, includes the kidneys, right? And the kidneys are also important for excreting waste products from your plasma, and it regulates the concentrations of electrolytes like sodium and potassium and bicarbonate. And when you regulate bicarbonate, what's something else that you're regulating? You're regulating the pH of your body as well. Now, how should your pH change in your body? Very, very little. So the kidneys are very important for maintaining pH homeostasis in your body. Okay, so I don't think we're going to go over these slides very much. I'm sure you recognize all of these structures right here. And so here's a nice cross-section of the kidney. And so what have you got? Well, you got the capsule on the outside. This first layer is the cortex. Okay, then the next layer is the medulla, and you can see the renal pyramid separated by the renal columns right here. All right, and the structural and functional unit of the kidney is this nephron right here. And the nephrons exist sometimes, or part of the nephron exists in the cortex, and other parts exist in the pyramid right here. There are no nephrons in the columns right here. Those are mostly for blood vessels that are bringing blood to the glomerulus. Okay. And so the pyramids produce urine, and then that urine then flows out of this renal papillae right here at the tip of a renal pyramid into this collecting area, which we call a calyx, right? And there are major and minor calyxes. A minor calyx comes from one pyramid, and a major calyx is when we have an anastomosis of two or more minor calyxes. So here is a major calyx, and then urine flows into the renal pelvis and then down this ureter to the urinary bladder. Okay, so here is a part of the nephron that shows pretty much just the tubular elements that make a nephron up. And we have the Bowman's capsule. I guess your book likes to call that the glomerular capsule. So Bowman's capsule and the glomerular capsule is the same. And bringing the filtrate from the glomerular capsule into the nephron, we have this first segment right here, which is called, does it look straight to you or a lot of curves? A lot of curves, right? And if something has a lot of curves, like the surface of our cerebral cortex, we say it is convoluted, right? So anything that has a lot of twists and turns in it is convoluted. Like if you ever tried to read a proposition at the state of California, it probably makes no sense because it's a very convoluted discussion. All right. So the first one is the proximal one, and then we have a loop of Henle, and then we've got the second convoluted tubule, which we call the distal convoluted tubule, and then that empties the filtrate into the collecting duct, and by the time it's in the collecting duct, we call it urine. All right, so we're going to look at some of these different structures. I don't think you can read about this micturition reflex, but it's pretty easy to understand. So I'm going to skip over it, but you should read through it and understand it. All right, so what is the structural and functional unit of urine formation in the kidney? That is the nephron, right? And the process that produces urine, okay, occurs in three steps. So there are three separate steps. The first step is glomerular filtration. The second step is tubular reabsorption. And the third step is tubular secretion. And all 1 million nephrons in your kidney do this job constantly. Okay? All right, so let's look at the nephron. We're going to break the nephron down into two major groups of structures. There are tubular elements. Here are all the tubular elements, right? We got Bowman's capsule. Sometimes we call that the glomerular capsule. Then, like we've just seen, you got the proximal convoluted tubule, and then the loop of Henle. The first part is the descending that goes down into the medulla, and then the ascending brings the filtrate back up from the medulla into the cortex, where it passes through the distal convoluted tubule and then finally into the collecting duct. All right, so this is how the correct order, the correct sequence of the tubular system of a nephron. And then there are vascular elements. Okay, what kind of material is in a vascular element of a nephron? It's going to be, somebody said it, but not very many people said that. What's in your blood vessels? Yeah, blood. So, all right, the vascular elements contain blood, right? Arteriole right here, capillary, right? So that means blood. But what's the fluid in the tubular elements? It's going to have one of two designations. Okay? In Bowman's capsule, it is filtrate. It is not urine, but it's going to be processed by these tubular elements right here so that by the time it reaches the collecting duct, then that filtrate is called urine. And then the three processes that happen in these tubular elements right here to produce, that convert filtrate into urine, are, what do we call those three steps? Where are they at? Glomerular filtration, tubular reabsorption, and tubular secretion. Okay. All right, so I do want you to be able to draw these things. We have some really nice, I'm sure I put them in your study guide, the interactive exercises that you can get to online. Okay, so let's just draw this nephron out with these three processes really quick. So I'm going to erase hemoglobin right here. Right, so make absolutely sure you can draw it out because I want you to follow the discussion. So we got, do we have anything that looks like red? Is that red?
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. And then we've got something that looks like blue. All right, so this is not a really good blue. All right, so blue, we're going to, oh, that's nice. These are going to be the tubular elements. All right, and what kind of fluid is in a tubular element? Filtrate in some part, or eventually urine, and filtrate is going to be converted into urine as we move. All right, and then the other part are going to be the vascular elements. And what do we have in vascular elements? Very good. Blood. Okay. So let's draw tubular elements first. And so what are we drawing right here? The nephron. Okay. How many nephrons do you have in a kidney? About a million. Okay, you have a lot. All right, so here we have, what's the first part of a tubular element? Bowman's capsule, right? So Bowman's capsule, and filtrate originates in Bowman's capsule, and then it's going to proceed through something that is what? Convoluted. And that's what we call the proximal convoluted tubule. And then it's going to enter the loop of Henle. So right about this region right here is where we have the arcuate arteries and veins. So everything above that is the cortex. Everything below that is the medulla of the kidney. Okay. So here we have the descending loop of Henle. Fluid goes this way. Then it comes back up. This is the ascending loop of Henle. And then what do we got? The distal convoluted tubule, and then that is going to empty filtrate into this collecting duct. But once it's in the collecting duct, it's really not processed very much anymore, so we're not going to call that filtrate, we're going to call it urine. All right, so then we have filtrate in the tubules of the nephron sometimes. And your book maybe calls it ultrafiltrate, you can consider it to be the same thing. All right, so what did we just draw out? The tubular elements of the nephron. So we need to include what other kind of elements? The vascular elements. So what do you got? You got the cortical radiate arteries, right, coming off. Cortical radiate arteries, you got to step outside. Okay. Cortical radiate arteries. All right, and then branching off the cortical radiate arteries, you've got the, do I have it on the slide up there? Afferent arteriole, and that's going to feed a capillary bed in here, which we call the, say it, you got to say it, otherwise you'll never know how to spell it. Glomerulus, right? I'm just going to abbreviate that G. That's a very leaky kind of capillary. It's a fenestrated capillary. Remember, there's three kinds of capillaries, continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoid. That's a fenestrated. That's a pretty leaky capillary. So a lot of plasma leaks out from the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule through very small filtration slits and pores, what we call fenestrations. And so the material that leaks out because of pressure and the size of the molecule. And when you're separating molecules out by size through some kind of membrane, what do we call that kind of process? It's a passive process that is called, okay, by just the size. And you did that this morning when you made tea or coffee. You had some paper that only allows small molecules to go through but not big, crunchy parts. Unless you're like French coffee or something, you'd like it really crunchy. Okay, that is what? Filtration. All right, so I'm just going to put a 1 right here. All right, so 1 is filtration. And if you want to say glomerular filtration, that's fine. That's a process where small molecules leave the glomerulus and enter Bowman's capsule. Okay, and they're trapped in Bowman's capsule. They can't get out, so they start to move through the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, and then some of the blood that didn't get filtered or some of the fluid that didn't get filtered leaves the glomerulus, and that's what we call the efferent arteriole. So afferent enters, efferent leaves, and here is a special portal circulation. What's a portal circulation? You learned one in terms of the one between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. It's where you have two capillary beds back to back, right? So usually the usual circulation, you have an artery, a capillary bed, and a vein returning blood to the heart. But a portal circulation, you have an artery, a capillary bed, then a portal vessel, then a second capillary bed, and then a vein returning blood to the heart. Okay. All right, and what's the function of a capillary again? Exchange. And here, filtration is just a special form of exchange where a lot of fluid leaves. All right, here is the second capillary bed, like this. So here is the second capillary bed. This goes to a venule right here, which then goes back to that cortical radiate vein. So there is a capillary network around all of these tubular elements. And since they surround all the tubular elements, we call these the peritubular capillaries, PC, peritubular capillaries. And what's the function of a peritubular capillary? Exchange, because it's a capillary. Okay. Now, there are two kinds of processes that can take place between the tubular elements and these peritubular capillaries. All right, let me start right back up over here. So what kind of material gets filtered out? What's a good way to think about the material that gets filtered out? Tiny molecules, water, all right, glucose, sodium, chloride, magnesium, okay, potassium. All of those compounds can leave the blood and go into the filtrate. Large molecules like albumin and other kinds of proteins typically are too big to be filtered. And also, this membrane right here has a lot of negative charges on it. And you know from going back to electrophysiology, generally, what kind of charge does a protein have on it? It's negative, right? And that's what draws potassium inside the cell. Okay, so proteins have a negative charge. So these membranes have a negative charge, and albumin has kind of a negative charge. And what can you tell me about like charges? They repel each other. So the charge of this membrane here kind of repels proteins, so they have a tendency to stay in the blood. They don't get filtered. But other compounds can get filtered. For instance, things that are probably pretty good for your body, like H2O, glucose. All right. If glucose gets filtered, where is it going to end up? If glucose is in this filtrate right here, where is it going to end up? It's going to go proximal convoluted tubule, loop of Henle, distal convoluted tubule, collecting duct, and in the urine. All right. Now, how good is that to have glucose in the urine? What can you do with glucose? Well, you can make ATP, which means you can go play soccer or take a test, right? All kinds of different things with ATP, and you need glucose for that. So do you want to be peeing glucose out of your body? No. That would be like going to a gas station, filling up your car with gasoline, and then poking a hole in the gasoline tank with an ice pick or something. All right, so a complete waste of energy. All right, so nonetheless, glucose gets into the filtrate through what kind of process? Filtration right here. But you don't want it going into urine. So way back when, we actually saw the mechanism by which glucose is resorbed from the filtrate and put back in the blood. And we got kind of a nice slide that shows that, but I'm just going to give you a little example. So here we start with the filtrate, and then things are put back in the blood. And what kind of things are put back in the blood? Well, like glucose and water, because you don't want to dehydrate either. This step number two right here is what we call tubular reabsorption. And different segments of the nephron right here have different abilities to absorb different things at different rates. Some are adjusted to regulate the amount of water or sodium that is being resorbed, and we're going to talk about those next time. All right, we're just understanding some of the basics. All right, but in the blood, there are some things that can be dangerous for you. For instance, a breakdown product of amino acids is urea. It's a nitrogenous compound. It's highly toxic. And not all the urea gets filtered. So that means that there is some urea that's left in the efferent arteriole. You don't want that in your body. So the job of these tubular elements right here and the peritubular capillaries is to take something like urea. That is where? Where is this urea at? It didn't get filtered. Where is it at?
Blood.
And these cells put it in the filtrate. And then where does it go? It's excreted as urine. All right, so urea would be a good example. How about excess sodium? Maybe you went out drinking a lot of margaritas last night. Or excess hydrogen ions. You had something very acidic, like acetic acid in salad dressing or something. Or you drank a bunch of Coke, which is highly acidic. All right, so excess ions can be secreted into the filtrate, and so that this third step right here is what we call tubular secretion. All right, so everything can get filtered if it's small enough. Good things that your body does not want to lose in urine get resorbed by tubular reabsorption. Excess deleterious molecules in your body can be secreted into the filtrate to get them out of your body. So those are the three steps. All right, filtration, tubular reabsorption, tubular secretion. All right, so the other thing that you should know about these is what direction. You should have that kind of on the tip of your tongue. Which direction do compounds go for filtration? Which way do they go? Blood to filtrate. What about tubular reabsorption? Material moves from filtrate to blood. And for tubular secretion, it goes blood to filtrate. Okay, so that's the job of the nephron, and after the filtrate has been processed, right, you end up with urine. All right, so it's going to be the result of sympathetic stimulation, sympathetic innervation to the kidney, and hormones that act on the kidney to regulate these processes, these three processes right here, right, so that you excrete what your body doesn't need, right, and retain things that your body does need, like water. Okay, you can't get rid of all the water that is filtered in that first step right there. Cortical radiate artery. So where's that cortical radiate artery at? Well, let's see. We probably don't have, well, here is renal artery, right? Then the first branch are the segmental arteries, and then they branch again between the lobes. Those are the interlobar arteries. This is maybe coming back to you. And then over, arching over the base of every pyramid are the arcuate arteries, and then branches off those arcuate arteries poke up into the cortex, and those would be called the cortical radiate arteries. All right, so those that poke up into the cortex have branches coming off of them called the afferent arterioles. Okay. You might have a better... Oh, well, here's the arcuate artery right here. Here's the cortical radiate artery. And then here is the afferent arteriole bringing blood into the glomerulus. Now, an older term for cortical radiate artery is an interlobular, but nobody uses that term anymore. Okay, so you can forget that one. So there was a difference between an interlobar and interlobular, and it got just too terribly confusing. Okay. All right. There is another term All right, so here we have a cross-section of a kidney. All right, so here is the renal capsule, connective tissue. Here is the cortex, and that's separated from the medulla by these arcuate arteries and veins right here. All right, and I see Bowman's capsule, or the glomerular capsule with the glomerulus inside of it. And so here is a vascular element, here is a tubular element, but of course these are what? Existing inside of each other. So if we look at this structure and not break it down into its components, but look at the glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule, sometimes we call that the renal corpuscle. All right, so there's some, could be some confusing terminology right here. Renal corpuscle is when you have the glomerulus with Bowman's capsule together, and of course that's really how it exists in nature together. All right, there are two kinds of nephrons that we have in the kidney, and we see them on this slide right here. There are nephrons that exist mostly in the cortex, and only a little bit of the loop of Henle goes down into the medulla. So we call these cortical nephrons. These are the ones that are working most of the time in your body. Then we have other nephrons, right, that spend a lot more time. The loop of Henle goes way deep into the medulla, and we call these the juxtamedullary nephrons. And we're not going to talk too much about the juxtamedullary nephrons except for the following point. There are ways for the kidney to excrete a lot of salt and very little water when you're in a dehydrated state. So when you're in a dehydrated state, then the kidneys need to make a very salty urine, but very little volume so that you retain that water. So it's the job of these juxtamedullary nephrons to make a very low volume urine that is very salty. All right, so that's one thing I want you to do for you to know for sure about the juxtamedullary nephrons. But we're not going to look and see how that really happens in this class. Okay, the proximal convoluted tubule consists of a single layer of cuboidal cells with just millions and millions of microvilli. And these microvilli, what can you tell me about microvilli? Where have, in anatomy, where did you find microvilli before? Microvilli. It's a, like an organelle on the apical surface of an epithelium. And what's the function of a microvillus? Do they, is it for motility? Do they sweep? No. Oh, what am I confused with? That's a cilia. Alright, so cilia is for motility. What about microvilli? Okay, so here we have like a cuboidal cell and it's got microvilli on it like this. Okay, so what you should think of is take this cell and if you make it flat, you get what? A surface area for exchange, right? It's a doorway. But if we take the cell and flatten it out, what happens? It increases the surface area so you have more exchange as a result of having these microvilli. So they're not motile, it just increases the surface area of the doorway for exchange. All right, the proximal convoluted tubule is very important for reabsorption of salt, like sodium, potassium, water, and other molecules needed by the body. Give me another molecule, for instance, glucose, right, okay. And so the proximal convoluted tubule is working 100% to resorb as much water and salt and glucose as possible. There is no regulation in the proximal convoluted tubule. It is working 100%. That would be like you stepping in your car, turning the engine on, and hitting the gas pedal all the way to the floor. All right, and the car is just going to go uncontrollable. So regulation in the kidney does not happen in the proximal convoluted tubule. It just resorbs. As a matter of fact, almost 100% of the potassium that is filtered in the renal corpuscle is reabsorbed, put back in the blood by the proximal convoluted tubule. It just does that job. Okay? All right, which means then that regulation adjustments, the fine adjustments to urine formation are performed by the loop of Henle and the distal convoluted tubule and the collecting duct. So those are the parts that we're really going to look at. Okay. The first step. What's the first step in urine production called? Yeah. It's called glomerular filtration. All right. So the glomerular capillaries and Bowman's capsule filter blood. These glomerular capillaries are fenestrated. They have large pores between the endothelial cells, big enough to allow many or all small molecules to pass through them. Right, and these fenestrated capillaries are up to 400 times more permeable compared to continuous capillaries. So that if we look at them, here is the wall of Bowman's capsule, right? And then the wall of Bowman's capsule is continuous and moves over each one of these capillaries that make up the glomerulus. So sometimes we call this the parietal layer of the glomerular capsule, and then these cells, since they're continuous with Bowman's capsule, we call this the visceral division of Bowman's capsule. That's a nice model that you use to think of what kind of membrane in your body. There's two kinds of membranes. There's mucous membranes and serous membranes. They line different cavities, different kinds of cavities. What kind of cavity does a mucous membrane line? That's a cavity that's open to the outside world, like your oral cavity, nasal cavity, gastrointestinal tract, reproductive tract, but you have other cavities that are not open to the outside world. Give me an example of one that's not open to the outside world. How about one that's holding your heart? What do you call that? The pericardial cavity, and it has a special membrane. It's not a mucous membrane, it's a serous membrane. And remember, a serous membrane has how many parts to it? It's got three parts, right? There's the parietal division, the visceral division, and there's fluid between the two, right? So use that same model to think of this glomerulus right here. Here is the parietal division. Here is the visceral division of Bowman's capsule. And in between the two, you have fluid. Okay. All right, so fluid leaks out. Plasma leaks out, minus the big proteins, because of these filtration slits and these fenestrations in the endothelium of the capillary, right? But these, there's a lot of protein in this area, so that prevents many protein molecules like albumin from filtering out. Now, if there is damage to this glomerulus, proteins can leak out from the plasma into Bowman's capsule, and where can they end up? They end up in urine. We call that proteinuria, right? And that's a sign of nephritis or kidney disease when that happens. Okay. And of course, since these fenestrations are so small, red blood cells can't get through this filtration membrane as well. But if you do have blood in the urine, what is that another sign of? Nephritis or kidney disease, right? Because blood cells should not go from the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule right here. Okay. So I think I talked about all that. Here's just a really fancy micrograph scanning, electron micrograph of the visceral Bowman's capsule, right? And you can see the filtration slits of these podocytes right here that help make the filtration membrane. Okay, so only a fraction of the plasma proteins are filtered. Most stay within the blood. So here is the afferent arteriole, here is the efferent arteriole. But all of the other smaller plasma solutes like sodium, potassium, glucose end up in the ultrafiltrate. All right, so this process, what is this process called? Filtration, glomerular filtration. So name the process by which small plasma solutes enter glomerular filtration. Oh, I just asked you that. Good question. Okay. All right, so glomerular filtration rate determines the volume of filtrate produced by both kidneys per minute. The average is 115 milliliters per minute in women, 125 milliliters per minute in men. So your small bottles right there, I think, are 500 mLs. All right, is that 500 mLs? Okay, so about one-fifth of that every minute are filtered by your kidneys. So if you were to add up, how many minutes are there in a day? Well, there's a lot, right? Hundreds, hundreds and hundreds of minutes. So if we were to add up all that fluid per day, that's 180 liters, right, get filtered. That's 45 gallons get filtered by the glomerulus every day. So you can imagine what would happen to your blood pressure if that fluid was lost in the urine. You would dehydrate in just a number of minutes, right? Because you're losing over 100 mLs every minute. or by that filtration slit. So what does that mean? Most of the water that is filtered has to be resorbed, or death would result in just a matter of minutes as a result of producing urine. All right, so water reabsorption, very important process that happens in the proximal convoluted tubule. Otherwise, you would dehydrate, not instantaneously, but almost. Water resorption. Okay, so glomerular filtration is controlled by some mechanisms, right? Because that filtration is going to determine how much fluid is lost from the blood. There are both extrinsic and intrinsic mechanisms for controlling the amount of filtration, or what we call glomerular filtration rate. Intrinsic regulation is sometimes what we call autoregulation as well. So the most important, one of the most important things for determining glomerular filtration is the degree of vasoconstriction or vasodilation of the afferent arterioles, right? Because as the afferent arteriole vasoconstricts, what happens to blood flow through the glomerulus, right? Because of Poiseuille's law, if there's vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole, that drastically reduces blood flow, that's drastically going to reduce glomerular filtration as a result. Right, or if there's vasodilation, then glomerular filtration will increase. Typically, what kind of nervous system do you know is responsible for vasoconstriction? Somatic nervous system? Autonomic nervous system? And who would say autonomic nervous system? Yeah, you can't control the state of vasoconstriction in your blood vessels. It's an autonomic response. And furthermore, then you have to pick which one. Sympathetics cause vasoconstriction, okay? So sympathetic activity constricts the afferent arteriole. That helps maintain blood pressure because it reduces glomerular filtration. And instead of going through the nephron, it just goes back to the heart and muscles. All right, so sympathetic stimulation is what we call an extrinsic mechanism. It's not just due to the kidney. It's due to what? The sympathetic control center in the medulla, so it requires a central nervous system. All right, so here we have a nice response loop. And what does the response loop always start with? A nice stimulus. All right, so we have a couple stimuli right here, maybe a decrease in blood pressure or even exercise. If there's a decrease in blood pressure, what part of your nervous system is going to be able to sense that decrease in blood pressure? What's a receptor for blood pressure? Baroreceptor, right? Make sure you know baroreceptor reflex for that test. All right, so the baroreceptor reflex then is going to send signals to the vasomotor center in the medulla oblongata. And the vasomotor center is going to say, oh, decrease in blood pressure. All right, that integration center is going to make a decision to increase sympathetic nerve activity, right? So sympathetic nerve activity has what kind of effect on the heart? It has both positive inotropic and positive chronotropic effects on the heart. So you increase stroke volume, increase heart rate, and if you increase heart rate and stroke volume, what are you increasing? Cardiac output. Remember, cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. Okay. Increased sympathetic activity on blood vessels causes vasoconstriction. And vasoconstriction increases peripheral resistance, right? And vasoconstriction in the skin and GI tract, that's going to increase peripheral resistance. What happens to blood pressure if you increase peripheral resistance? Is it directly related? Oh, you got to derive that equation, right? Blood pressure is equal to, vasoconstriction will increase peripheral resistance and blood pressure will increase because blood pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. So if resistance increases, so does blood pressure. Okay. So the effect of sympathetic activity on the kidneys is causing vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole. You're going to have less blood flow into the glomerulus, so what happens to the filtration rate when less blood is going through the glomerulus? It's going to decrease, And when filtration decreases, that's going to produce a decrease in urine, which then also increases blood pressure, right? So increased cardiac output, increased peripheral resistance, and increased blood volume will increase blood pressure, right? So what's the relationship between this increase in blood pressure compared to the stimulus, which was a decrease in blood pressure? Do they add or subtract? They subtract from each other, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism, right, which includes the heart, blood vessels, as well as the kidney to maintain proper blood pressure. All right, but that's an extrinsic mechanism. So next time, we're going to start with intrinsic mechanisms. And to give you a little foreshadowing, there's two kinds of intrinsic mechanisms. There's a myogenic response, okay, and then there's tubuloglomerular feedback. These are both intrinsic mechanisms which regulate glomerular filtration. Okay, that's it for today. Okay, I'm 31. What happened? I'm sorry, go ahead. The fifth test? Really? I don't know if I don't know if I can agree with that or not.
You have to.
Okay.
Usually
is it more related to the figures or what?
No, it must be. I can't, because then you'll think I'm a bad student, but I haven't really read much of the chapters this time.
Okay.
But usually I listen to your lecture, then I go over the questions, and I can answer most of them without even going to the book because you've covered.
No, I think the material just might be a little bit. Turn this off.
I don't want everybody
you know what?